Welcome to another edition of The Brand Called You, a video and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Today, I am privileged to have a very, very accomplished individual, Dr. Noorjahan Safia Niaz. Noorjahan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Noorjahan is the co-founder of the Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan, BMMA. She is working on addressing issues of Muslim women for the last 28 years. She's played a key role in getting legislation against triple talaq. She's established Darul Uloom in Niswan as a center for learning and awareness in Islam. And she's been awarded and recognized all over India and all over the world. So, Noorjahan, tell me, what would you say are three key milestones in your life or your career?
So, I started working in 1992. Mm-hmm. And I passed out of TISS in June 92. Okay. And as we all know, December 1992 happened. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I entered my work life, I would say that as my first milestone, although it cannot be 6 months within your journey that you get a milestone, but it really turned my perception towards myself,
right,
towards my community, towards the social fabric of the country, the rising communalism thereafter. And that incident also exposed to me my own privilege and my responsibility as well, that I need to do something for the community that I am born in. Mm-hmm. Which eventually will benefit the nation and the larger cause of how do we stay together as a country and as a community. So that I would say is the first.
Okay.
Starting BMMA joining hands with Zakia and starting Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan. Mm-hmm. I would say is the this was 2007. Mm-hmm. And in between 92 and 2007 was a lot of experience with different organizations, different NGOs, but the focus remained Muslim women and Muslim community largely.
Right.
And a lot of experiences and which kind of culminated into this national platform where some of us felt that Muslim women are really doing a lot of work in the ground, but that needs to kind of get consolidated and the national platform is required.
Okay.
So getting to start BMMA in 2007 was the second milestone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think after that, whatever happened in BMMA has been a milestone.
Milestone,
whether
milestone.
getting the legislation against a practice which has been kind of hounding the community for decades now. Mm-hmm. You know, working towards getting the Haji Ali judgment for reallowing women to enter the sanctum.
Wonderful.
Or setting up these training centers, we call them the Karwa centers, where a lot of livelihood work happens with young people. Mm. Or setting the Darul Uloom in this one, where for the first time formally we established an organization to train Muslim women to become qazis.
Mm.
So that is one program, but the idea was to look at Islam, look at our own religion from a feminist perspective.
Correct.
And we came up with some very amazing interpretations, and a lot of work is happening by Muslim women, you know, and the start of Islamic feminist movement with Musawa and all these international organizations, Sisters in Islam. So I was very inspired by them, and also a kind of feeling of being supported, because what we're doing in India is being done by Muslim women across context, where whether they are in a majority like Pakistan or Iran, or whether they are in a minority like us, like in Sri Lanka. So a lot of Muslim women have already gone so much ahead in understanding Islam from a completely fresh perspective.
Yeah, perspective. I agree with
you. So all those have been
fantastic.
Have been learning experiences all along.
Fantastic. So let's talk about the Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan. Tell me a little bit about this organization and the kind of work you are doing there.
Yeah. So, we started this in 2007, and it took us about 2 years to actually work on it, because, as I said, I've been working in with Muslim women in Mumbai for the last, since 92 onwards. Zakia was working in Gujarat for so many years, and there were a lot of our own, who are now state conveners in BMMA, working in their respective cities for many years, and we would keep bumping into each other in various meetings and seminars. And so we knew that this kind of a treasure is already existing, and what are we doing about it? And around the same time, around 2004-05, there was also a kind of a disenchantment with the existing women's movement. We have a very robust feminist movement in our country for many decades now, and specifically, you know, after the 70s, a lot of legislations that we've got for women today is thanks to the women's movement. But unfortunately, there was very little understanding of Muslim women's issues or what the Muslim women want, their aspirations, their, because all of us are rooted in our religious beliefs. Correct. But that did not have much of resonance within the larger movement. And then we felt that if we have to address Muslim women's issues, we cannot cherry pick and keep our religious identity aside and talk about issues. Right. Because issues of Muslim family law reform are rooted in religion and culture and tradition. Absolutely. And you cannot discard those and talk about reforms.
Correct.
And we felt that if we don't start a separate safe space for Muslim women, we will never get to, we'll never be able to address this issue. Okay. So, like some decades back, women's rights was never an issue. A lot of people would say, no, human rights frameworks are enough. No, that covers everybody. So, why do we need a women's movement? No, you are dividing the human rights movement by talking about only women.
Correct.
But then if we didn't have a women's movement, we wouldn't have addressed the issues of women. We wouldn't have got so much of legislations. Similarly, when we started BMM, or when we thought of having a stream of, within the larger women's movement, a stream of Muslim women, because the specifics are there because of their identity. And the same question, why do we need a Muslim women's movement when we already have a, and the answer to them was what they gave some decades back, that if we don't make it specific, we will never get to address. Similarly, for Dalit women, there are, the issues with other women are common.
Correct.
But there are certain issues which emerge because you're a Dalit, or because you're a sex worker, or because you're a construction worker, or because you're a Muslim woman, or because you're a tribal woman. So it's not cutting away from it, but adding a dimension to the movement. So Zakia and I, we got together and we started working on it. We got a few other friends together and we spent about 2 years working on our vision statement.
Okay.
So what is going to be our ideology? What is going to be our value base? Are we going to be a movement or an NGO or a federation or an alliance? Because by that time, we had experimented with all these methods and things were not working out really. And it took us 2 years and we came up with our vision statement, which if I have to really put it in a short time, we wanted it to be a movement and not a registered organization or a federation, because we felt that an only a movement will be able to give that kind of space for hundreds of women to join in, because a movement is really huge and it's unstructured and it's also informal, and as long as you agree to the vision and the objectives and the values, you can join. So anybody.
But isn't Andolan and movement the same?
No, it is. It is. So in Hindi we say it, the Andolan. In English it's movement.
Okay.
So so that was the structure that we thought that we need to have. Then
but
we
tell me, you know, if we now talk about the challenges that are faced by only Muslim women, by women in our country. What about, what are your thoughts on how are these challenges different from a lot of women in the rest of the world in developing countries?
Yeah. So, if we have to look at country-wise, then we've, a lot of our problems as Muslim women come because of this very tragic incident that happened in 1947. So, although we got our independence, the country got divided, and the partition has been the biggest, what to say, there's a reason for what we are today, not just as Muslim women, but also as community. Because if we read history of Muslim women just before independence, like in the 30s and 40s, lot of Muslim women had formed organizations like what we're doing now. It was already happening in the 30s. And Muslim women are asking for the very same things that we have been asking today. In fact, they were a step ahead, and they were also asking a ban on parda. And those kinds of things in open forums. So imagine if that the partition wouldn't have happened. We would have the best of Muslim women leading the movement itself, not just Muslim women's movement, but leading the women's movement itself. Mm-hmm. But that section really migrated, and then we were left with a kind of the most assetless, poor, the kind of population got left behind. And unfortunately, they were led by a set of people who were rooted in religion, only religion.
Correct.
Getting rooted in religion is not a problem. But if you look at the issues of the community only from a particular lens, then that was a problem.
Correct.
So,
correct.
We were led by Jamaat-e-Islami and Darul Uloom Deoband, and the All India Muslim Personal Law Board came up in the 70s, and the Shah Bukhari, that was the kind of leadership we had. So one can imagine what we can see the consequence of.
I agree. So, let's talk a little bit about, what you achieved with the triple talaq legislation.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about some of the challenges you faced. I mean, I think it's something incredible that you achieved.
So the first challenge, as I said earlier, is why a Muslim women's movement?
Right.
So we had to go into the vision and the fact that certain of our issues emerge from certain religious practices. And if we don't root ourselves there, we will never be able to challenge it. So that is the first thing that we had to face. A lot of questions from the women's movement, a lot of questions from, of course, within the community. Because within the community, you're not supposed to be seen, you're not supposed to be heard, you have been invisibilized for so many decades. So how come this set of women are now emerging, and what is this movement that they have started? And look at them, they don't even look Muslim. So they don't have their heads covered, and they don't wear the hijab or whatever. Believe me, a lot of those kinds of things that we have gone through in different meetings that we've had. The focus is not what I'm saying, but the focus is on how I'm looking and what I'm wearing and what I'm. So that is where the community was, or I would say a part of it is still there. And so that was one challenge. When we started to talk about religion, when we started to talk about all these practices of polygamy, underage marriages within the Muslim, the family law issues, not really going beyond looking, because we are not a faith-based organization. Yeah. We are a rights-based organization. Mm. So looking, not really looking at religion per se, but looking at the legal issues. So divorce, marriage, maintenance, custody of children, adoption, guardianship, inheritance, looking at all these issues from the Quranic perspective.
Okay.
So if there is a triple talaq happening, then what does the Quran have to say about triple talaq or about polygamy or any of these issues? And that's where the education, self-education in that sense began.
Okay.
Which also began much before BMMA started, but it kind of continued and became more focused within BMMA. And to our surprise, none of these practices have any sanction in the Quran. They are part of the practices of a patriarchal society, where because you have a hegemony and control over religion, and the religious scripture, you say what you want to say.
Correct.
And then when questions are asked, you say, well, on religion, women are not supposed to speak. In fact, nobody is supposed to speak except the ulema and the maulanas. And so whatever they say is sacrosanct, and what they're saying is divine, and it's the truth. And when we started to question those, so we read the Quran. So what stops us from reading it ourselves? In that sense, we are not a very centrally held community. Sunni Muslims, especially in our country, we are the majority.
Correct.
And Sunni Muslims are not really very structurally strongly organized, like say, for instance, the Bora community or the Khoja community. So we are open. We don't have to take anybody's permission to whether to read the Quran or not.
Yeah.
And they've been so smart, they've been asking us to read the Quran only in Arabic. Because that will give us more but we said, no, samajh mein to aana chahiye kya kya hai usme. So we would read in different, and we realized that these practices have got no sanction. And that gave us a lot of strength. It was really very empowering, because that's the language in which we had to talk back to them. So if they throw us things from the Hadith and from the Sharia, We throw that back things to them from the Quran, because Quran is higher, and it's the divine word. It's come straight from Allah. So if God is not sanctioning triple talaq, in fact, the Quran has got multiple verses which talk about pre-divorce processes.
Yes.
Reconciliation, arbitration, sit and talk, you know, physically be away from each other so that you get a perspective. Even if then you are not able to stay together, then a divorce process begins, which also has to last for 3 months.
Correct.
Within that also reconciliation. And you are shocked that this is what the Quran is saying, and this is what these people have been telling us, that it's in a matter of seconds the marriage can be dissolved. It's the right of the men to do it.
Yeah.
Similarly for marriage and for the age of marriage, polygamy, and we got that strength, and we spend a lot of time educating women about their rights within the Quran. And I'm specifically saying Quran and not Islam, because Islam would also include all these other patriarchal interpretations.
Correct.
So that was another challenge. That why are you talking about religion? Aap chup raho. Ye aapka kaam nahi hai. Ye hamara kaam hai. And that really put them, that really disturbed them, because now they realize that it's, you know, it's moving away. And we use the same arguments in the court.
It has often been said, and you know, I think you are reinforcing that. If you educate a woman, you educate a home. Family,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Is there a lot of focus that is now happening in the Muslim young women for education?
Lot of. In fact, in my own span of time that I have spent in the community, I see that there's a huge upswing. I mean, a lot of earlier when I had started work, 8th standard, 9th standard, would be the 7th or 8th. No? That was that time also the cutoff where you move from a municipal school to a private school. And that would be all, no, for a girl to educate herself. Over a period of time, no, dasvitak ho jana chahiye. She should at least clear her 10th class. And now I see that, I mean, some decades back it would be 12th. Barvi to pad lena chahiye. And now, currently I see that she should at least be a graduate. And it is happening. A lot of girls are doing. Poverty remains the biggest
correct
stumbling block.
Yes.
But otherwise, the aspirations are high.
Very nice. And you know, I've often said that, you know, I'm much older than you are, but you know, this world now belongs to our millennials and the Gen Zs.
Absolutely.
Right? Who are 33, 34, 25, 28.
Yes, yes.
When I talk to my children who both live abroad, for them, religion is important, but it is not something which is discriminatory.
Yeah.
What are your views on the Muslim girls and their thinking in the modern world now?
Yeah. So, we have a group called Seher Group, where we work with young people. So, we have a Seher Group with young girls and Quran Group with young boys. And when we talk to them, they all they talk about is education, work, livelihood. Where can I get a better job? Where can I educate myself? Where can I get, you know, scholarships for my education? Where can I get somebody to sponsor my fees? Where can I get better work? So this has been the case all along.
Correct.
Okay. But so much is also the contribution of our leadership, of our so-called, why so-called? It has always been a religious leadership all along. It's only in the last decade or so that we see that a lot of young people are emerging, specifically now after the last year's anti-CAA NRC movement. A lot of young people have emerged. And because we also take students from TISS for internship, and a lot of Muslim girls come in there for their internship. And I see that they are able to look at the community without the lens of religion. All of us are believers. Nobody is rejecting religion.
Absolutely.
But looking at the social aspect, the economic aspect, the political aspect, the spiritual aspect. Also, what we have also seen is that religion itself has been started to being looked differently. Of course, you always have a, given the kind of political environment that we are living in today, which is so openly anti-Muslim, and the kind of things that have happened in the last 6 years. It is pushing the community back into their very narrow religious identity, which has actually been happening for the last 7 decades. It's now getting more enhanced and very open and very on your face kind of thing. But it's not new, right? It's been always been happening. The ghettoization, the physical, emotional, mental ghettoization of the communities. We are in a post-ghettoized world. So that has impacted the community in a large way. But in spite of that, I can see the struggle to establish, to do something, to look at to how to better our lives and correct. How to also take religion along for your empowerment. Religion cannot be used to depress you, to bring you down, to push you into a smaller identity. But how can it be an enhancing, facilitative process? To which, as BMME, we have kind of done a bit of contribution towards that.
So, you know, I've got time for one more question. And, you know, when I was reading about you, you said that you want to work towards codifying the Muslim family law in India. Can you help me understand this comment?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it's quite simple. If you look at the other family laws, we had the Hindu Code Bill, which was passed in 1955, thanks to Ambedkar and Nehru. They really pushed that and they got the Hindu Code Bill, which covers marriage, divorce, inheritance, succession. Practically all issues of family law are covered by these four important legislations way back in 55.
Correct.
In fact, before that, 1936, we have the Parsi Marriage and Divorce Act. 36. I mean, this was done by the British government.
Right.
The Christian Marriage Act, Marriage and Divorce Act, or the name, what I don't know the name, but the marriage, Christian Marriage and Divorce Law was codified even before that, 1872. By the British, and over a period of time, a lot of amendments have happened. And the Hindu Code Bill covers the Hindus, the Sikhs, the Jains, and the Buddhists.
Correct.
So, practically all communities have a codified family law. Now, why is a codified family law important? Because if you have a problem, then where do you go? You will go to the state, you will go to the police station, you will go to the courts. And the police and the court take decision based on laws which are passed by the parliament. Okay, they will not do anything else. Of course, they'll end up doing everything else other than what is written in the law. That's another thing. But on paper, technically, they are supposed to follow the written law.
Correct.
Yeah. So in all other matters, of course, implementation with the Hindu Code Bill is not great. We know how the police works and how the courts function. But that's a different, separate issue itself. But at least they have a law on paper passed by the highest decision-making, apex, decision-making body of the country. If you look at the Muslim law, the first codification attempt was made by Muslim women and a lot of religious groups at that point of time, in 1937.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The second law came in 1939. That is why my reference to the partition, if partition had not happened, we would have probably got the first codified law for the Muslims in the country. But that didn't happen, and the first law came in 37, which only said that Muslim community will be governed by the Sharia. That's it. There's nothing substantial in that law. 39 Act gave the right to Muslim women to divorce her husband way back in 1939. So she could go to the court and file a complaint and she gets a divorce. 39 cut to 1986. 40 years, close to 40 years, no legislation. Correct. 55 happened, Hindu law happened. Christian law happened much earlier. No discussion on Muslim family law reforms at all till 1986. 1986 also was like a flash in the pan, because Shabanu happened and she went to the court and the Supreme Court. And then we had a legislation which actually cut down the Supreme Court judgment, which was in favor of Shabanu. It just said that a Muslim divorced woman can get maintenance only for the 3 months. Of course, the Supreme Court had a very, very progressive interpretation of that legislation. I mean, that legislation is a good legislation now. But that's it. So, till 1986, it was post-divorce maintenance through this law and the fact that she can go to the court to get a divorce. What should be the age of marriage? What about triple divorce? If the man has to divorce, what does he have to go anywhere? No, he just says three times and it's done. So, all other aspects of the family law were open to traditional interpretation of the Sharia. And that's why when we started BMMA, we felt that if we don't work on this issue, we will continue to have Muslim women who feel completely insecure in their own homes. Because we had public hearings and a lot of public getting Muslim women out in the open to speak about their issues and completely insecure. I don't know when he's going to divorce me. If the salt is less in my sabji, I might just be thrown out of the house.
Okay.
Or if I, and we have had cases where she's gone to her mother's house without informing him. She comes back and she's divorced by writing talaq on a piece of paper and throwing it on her face. And this, he at least took the effort to write it down. There were instances where even this was not done. So we felt that what the others have got way back, decades back, why should we as Muslim women not have the security of a codified law? Are we not citizens of this country? Don't we vote? Are we not born here? Are we not citizens here? So taking the constitutional guarantees, Article 14, 15, all of those.
Very well.
We are a citizen. We are Muslim women.
You have full rights as citizens.
And I have a right to be protected by the law, protected by the parliament. And that really pushed us into working towards codification of Muslim law. And we have a codified draft law ready for the government to implement. Of course, it doesn't want to look at it. That's another thing. But we have drafted the law ourselves.
Right. Very well said. Dr. Ooja, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. And I mean, you're doing incredible work. Things that you are doing, I think, are life-changing for the Muslim women, you know, and I'm sure people must be grateful to you. Thank you again, and I wish you lots of success.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to talk. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.